Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release today of the search warrant for the FBI raids on Michael Cohen's home, office, and hotel room, which, although heavily redacted, make it clear that Robert Mueller had his eye on Cohen much earlier than previously known and had probable cause to justify the raid on the grounds of bank fraud, money laundering, acting as a foreign agent, and violations of FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Adam Glasfeld, a reporter for Courthouse News Service, joins us to discuss his latest article, FBI Suspected Cohen as Foreign Agent Nearly a Year Before Raids, and examined Cohen's shell company Essential Consultants, which is supposed to be involved in real estate consulting work but ended up as a conduit for hush money to pay off the porn star Stormy Daniels a week before the election to keep her quiet about her affair with Donald Trump. The other revelation, among more than 4 million electronic and paper files, more than 12 mobile devices and iPads, 20 external hard drives, flash drives, and laptops, is the payments totaling $383,332.98 Michael Cohen received from companies owned by Viktor Vekselberg, a Russian oligarch close to Putin. Then we'll explore the disparity between press coverage and U.S. government priorities when it comes to terrorism by white nationalists, who are invariably described as deranged individuals and loners, while Muslim terrorists are reflective of a whole group of people. And they remain the principal focus of Homeland Security and counterterrorism activities and funding, while white Christian terrorism is a growing threat that gets insufficient attention and resources. David Shanzer, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, joins us to discuss how statements by President Trump and Congressman Steve King embolden and empower white nationalists and their violent racist ideology. Then finally, we'll look into the love fest in the White House Rose Garden today between President Trump and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, who called for, quote, traditional family lifestyles with respect to God and against politically correct attitudes and fake news. This had Trump swooning as he gushed, "I am very proud to hear the president use the term fake news." Alexander Main, the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who focuses on U.S. policy towards Latin America, joins us to discuss the growing scandal in Brazil tying the Bolsonaro family to the assassination of a councilwoman in Rio de Janeiro. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Adam Glasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Services, where his latest article is FBI Suspected Cohen as Foreign Agent Nearly a Year Before Raids. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Glasfeld.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Adam. And there was a lot of anticipation about these court filings. And it does seem that you sort of learn a lot about Mueller and where he's heading from all of the court filings. And these, I guess, how far do they go back? Because I guess your headline and the reporting indicates that Mueller was on to Cohen way before anybody thought he was.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we know from the documents that were released today, and there were eight of those documents that were spanning hundreds of pages. And we know for a fact that he was seeking information. He was seeking warrants as far back as July 2017, nearly a year before the raids. And he justified that search, finding probable cause on the reasons that you mentioned. Most surprisingly, and what became the headline here, that even back then, he found probable cause to search him as a suspected foreign agent. That's partly significant because, as you may remember, he was not charged as that at the time. But this goes into great detail these papers about his suspected ties to Ukrainian-born Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg, and shows how the money allegedly flowed to Cohen's shell company, Essential Consultants, which was, as you mentioned, the same vehicle used for the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels.
So what do you think Viktor Vekselberg wanted in return for the $583,000, $583,332.98?
Well, right now, the documents leave that. It's a very intriguing mystery here that it goes to. Basically, it's the first time that at least I have seen the FBI allege that that the money went through this route. They claimed that the money went from through essentially Columbus Nova, which has come out to deny it. But they claim that the money went to Columbus Nova, which was owned by, which was co-founded by Vekselberg's cousin. So it has the details right there, but it doesn't connect what they suspected Vekselberg wanted in return from Cohen. But what we see is a pattern generally through the Essential Consultants shell company was that Cohen was peddling access from the earliest days of the Trump White House when he peddled access to AT&T and Novartis. There was a big controversy. AT&T apologized. And we also see in the same search warrant materials that Cohen was financially very hard up. According to some of the information on the search warrant materials, it says that he was refinancing the debt on his taxi medallions. It was $22 million. He started in the month before the election trying to get rid of that debt, and he set up Essential Consultants on that month. So we see a pattern in those two companies, of at least, of access peddling. And that's why the foreign money that the FBI alleges is so such a momentous allegation.
Well, it seems like Cohen was in the equivalent of the buggy whip business when automobiles were discovered. I mean, the idea that you are selling New York City taxi medallions when taxi cabs are being wiped out by Uber, I can see why he was in debt. But Viktor Vekselberg is the same Viktor Vekselberg, is it not, who was running Maria Butina, the young Russian woman who was having an affair with an American who she didn't particularly like, but he introduced her to top people in the NRA and top people in the Republican power structure, if you will.
Viktor Vekselberg is a very significant figure, and his name has been floating around for a long time. As I mentioned earlier, when the AT&T revelations came out, that was the first time Vekselberg's name came up in connection to the Michael Cohen case. Actually, at the time, Michael Avenatti had released that report. And as I mentioned, this time it's very significant in that it now it's not just a report that journalists had uncovered or something that was exposed by Stormy Daniels' attorney. This is something that has the kind of weight and gravitas of the FBI putting it on paper that was unsealed today.
So again, I'm speaking with Adam Klasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is FBI suspected Cohen as foreign agent nearly a year before raids. One of the things that came out in the FBI or in the warrant applications is something that's called a stingray device known as Triggerfish, which locates which suite inside Manhattan's Lower Regency Hotel the cell phones of Michael Cohen's were that the Bureau wanted to grab. Were they cell phones that he was carrying? I mean, is this a some kind of sophisticated tracking device, or were they looking for passive cell phones? I mean, presumably they knew which hotel room he was in.
Well, one of the interesting things in the court papers is that they use that triggerfish device. They use that to kind of find out which of the rooms that he was in. They kind of go back and forth. Is it on I would have to consult the papers, but they essentially want to determine whether they are in one room or the one directly above or below it. So it was how they knew that the cell phones contained information related to emails that they couldn't access, related to Cohen's private practice. And that was one of the arguments they made to support the search warrant application. And the triggerfish helped them actually isolate the hotel room that he was staying in. They knew generally he was staying in the hotel building, but I can't, only judging from what I read in the court papers, it seems that they wanted to make sure that they knew where these devices were located so they could get those messages.
So, obviously, first of all, it looks like it was the New York Times that petitioned the courts for this material. Is that right?
That's right. They started they basically initiated the request that got the ball rolling. But then a number of news outlets joined them. The AP was one of them, New York Daily News, New York Post, Dow Jones. Pretty much everyone wanted access to these search warrants. And as we learned today, there was a lot to be learned. We learned that this investigation has been going on much longer than we previously knew. And, it's interesting. The last fight about a search warrant material that happened in this court was justifying the reopening of the Hillary Clinton investigation. And what happened in that case was we found out, well, there was really nothing much there in that search warrant. That's not what happened this time. This time we found 8 separate documents, hundreds of pages, detailed allegations, and, the story, the last time there was an open records battle of this magnitude, the big surprise was, in the case of Clinton, how little support there was to reopen that investigation. The big takeaway today was, my God, there are hundreds of pages, 8 documents, and we learned that this is a much more longstanding investigation than people previously suspected.
So what does that tell you then, Adam?
Well, it says that it shows that Mueller was really, that for all of the chance of, President Donald Trump constantly saying that this is a witch hunt, we see, well, no, there are detailed allegations. We know that, the response to the raid was attorney-client privileges dead. That was Trump's response. We learned that by the time that raid was ordered, it was approved by a judge, there was plenty of factual basis to underlie that. We could see hundreds of pages of a detailed list of probable cause. So it's one of the big takeaways of today is, I'm sure that, all of the reporters working diligently to sift through the avalanche of paperwork that was made public today, I'm sure that folks are still going to find new revelations based on, a footnote that was missed or a connection that was overlooked. So one of the things that it does tell us is that there is a lot of evidence and factual support that brought forward this case that has resulted in convictions on some very serious offenses by the personal attorney and fixer to the President of the United States.
Well, and by the way, I think I may have gotten the Vekselberg wrong in terms of his connection to Maria Butina. I think that it may have been Alexander Torshin, another oligarch, but it's hard to keep up. There are so many Russians. You shake a tree and a Russian falls out of it when it comes to the Trump administration. Yeah. Well, just in closing then, what do you think of you said that there may be some more stuff coming out of it. I think the point, isn't it, that these are people around Trump, and this was his personal lawyer and fixer. So it does seem that they're essentially building a case against Trump, aren't they? I mean, isn't that where all indications go? And it also looks that, makes it clear that the FBI is had a pretty aggressive approach. And one of the other targets we're starting to learn more about is Elliot Broidy, who may be even more, there may be even more explosive revelations coming out of him, including who it exactly was that made the playmate pregnant, that the big payoff was, which once that was made, then, of course, the White House rewarded him with connecting him up to the Emiratis, and he made $1 billion.
Well, in terms of what we learn from the revelations today, I'm not sure that what happened today kind of advances those particular stories you're telling about, you mentioned, but I will say that the government has before on the day, in the lead up to Michael Cohen's sentencing, implicated Trump in the campaign finance. I won't speculate on what that means for the future. But what I will say is that we have hundreds of pages made public today. We have probably thousands in the court record of this and other cases, showing that there is a lot for investigation. That this is a broad, expansive matter being pursued in multiple directions.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Adam Glasfeld. And let's stay in touch. This is obviously, who knows how many more shoes are going to drop here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Glasfeld, who's a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is FBI suspected Cohen as foreign agent nearly a year before raids. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how statements by President Trump and Congressman Steve King embolden and empower white nationalists and their violent racist ideology. Police and thieves in the street. Oh yes, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be, hear me, all the crimes committed. Take away his license to kill. Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Shanzer, Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch include special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel at the Department of Defense and a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanser.
Thank you, Ian.
And following the massacre in New Zealand, there's been a lot of discussions, and it seems to happen a lot whenever there's kind of a white nationalist terrorist. There's a tendency to always describe him as a loner, as a single deranged individual. Whereas when Muslim terrorism happens, and there was an incident in Holland just yesterday, the tendency is to paint them with a much broader brush that indicts a whole group of people. Is that a fair description, do you think?
Well, I think that mistake is sometimes made by the media and sometimes made by commentators. You know, but I agree we should, you know, treat both phenomenon similarly. The first important thing is, you know, both of them are terrorism. Terrorism, in my mind, is the use of violence against civilians to make a political point. And I think both the white supremacists and the Al-Qaeda, ISIS kind of inspired terrorists are both engaging in violence for politics. So it's both terrorism. So I'm glad this one was in New Zealand was pretty quickly identified as terrorism. So that's a slight change. I think that's for the better.
But is there a problem in this country in terms of priorities, particularly with Homeland Security, of dealing with what seems to be, and I believe there are statistics that bear this out, that there have been much, much fewer incidents of Muslim terrorism in this country or terrorism perpetrated by Muslims than there has been white nationalists? You've got McVeigh going back to Oklahoma City and a whole group of incidents that have happened, and of course some that were prevented, like the Coast Guard officer that was recently arrested. So is there an inventory there, and are you satisfied as somebody that deals with Homeland Security that there's a kind of focus on across the board rather than a selective focus?
Yes, I would agree that the resources are disproportionately allocated to the Al-Qaeda, ISIS-inspired forms of terrorism over the white supremacy. And so that is a problem. I mean, as far as the inventory, I don't really think it should be a competition. I mean, both are serious problems, depending on whether you're counting incidents or numbers of deaths, depending on how far back you go. You can kind of shade the statistics either way. It's interesting. Our kind of counting shows that the problems are about the same magnitude in terms of, you know, again, depending on how you count it. But in terms of allocation of resources with respect to numbers of FBI agents, numbers of analysts working the problem, I think you're right. We don't dedicate enough to dealing with the problem of white supremacy violence inside the United States. And it's been like that for quite some time.
So is it a question of leadership, at least at the moment, where we have a president who seems reluctant or incapable of criticizing white nationalists?
Well, it is a matter of leadership and priorities. I mean, in the United States, the budgets are ultimately approved by the Congress, so Congress can insist on resources, programs being funded, and so on. So it's not entirely up to the president, but a lot of executive branch actions are discretionary. So I would say that if you have a president who's just not that interested in this particular problem, you're not going to get as much energy and funding towards dealing with it as you would otherwise.
So what's it going to take to have a more balanced focus and to be more effective? Because, you know, there's a pattern of these things. And you know, I didn't mention the guy down in Florida who lived in his van festooned with pro-Trump propaganda, who sent out all these pipe bombs. And I did mention the Coast Guard officer who had a kill list. It does.
Well, the good news about the Coast Guard officer, of course, is that the FBI was on him. So that shows that there is an intelligence network. There are agents who are assigned to dealing with this. And obviously the pipe bomb and the things in the mail to the Democratic candidates prior to the election and all that is an event that wasn't caught ahead of time. And, you know, we had not that long ago the incident in New York with the Afghan refugee with the driving the truck along the bike route. So, unfortunately, we have sporadic but still very dangerous incidents. So I agree with you. I would like to see a more vigorous intelligence effort to kind of try to identify these individuals before they come, try to disrupt organizations. It's a little trickier constitutionally in the United States to kind of take efforts against groups that, you know, have a political bent, but also might be in the business of encouraging violence. They have a constitutional rights that, for example, Al-Qaeda acting abroad doesn't have. So we have more tools to go after the organizations, their funding, more surveillance powers than we do inside the United States. And that is one thing that makes the domestic terrorism trickier.
And again, I'm speaking with David Shanza, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch included special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel of the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. But the other day, the president himself seemed to, I don't know whether he could say he incited violence, but it was not too veiled a threat when he said, you know, the left plays a tougher game. It's very funny. I actually think that the people on the right are tougher, but they don't play it tougher. Okay, I can tell you I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until they get to a certain point, and then it would be very bad, very bad. That has concerned and alarmed a lot of people. What do you make of it?
Well, I just think those are comments, kinds of comments are both are bizarre and, you know, disgusting, really. You know, no president has the support of the military or the police. It's a ridiculous thing to say. We're a country made. We're a diverse country. We're made up of lots of people, different views, and it's just bizarre for anyone to say that and inaccurate. So that's the first thing. But you know, to call on people to get tougher in their politics, I'm sure he had something in his mind. I think the point to be made, really, about these kinds of this kind of violence, this form of violence, it's one thing that we're seeing in the United States, and my colleague Charles Kurzman and I put out a report on this in January. The number of ISIS and al-Qaeda incidents in the United States is at its low point since 2014, and a historically very low point, below 15 incidents in 2018. And I think the reason is because the movement is losing steam. I mean, they're losing the caliphate. They're just losing territory. They're not being successful. And I think the problem with white supremacy right now is that the movement is being successful. It's being seen as forcing changes to governmental policy and immigration, and here in Europe, it's being seen as electing parties and doing well in elections, and that inspires people when they think they're part of something that's working and popular, and they have these spokespeople like Trump, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, and others. When they seem to be on the ascendancy and powerful, that's when people feel like they can act out, they feel inspired to take action and use violence to perpetuate what they believe is a righteous cause. So you would like the leader of your nation and, frankly, leader of much of the world to be able to distinguish his own political objectives, which really are not important, from things like peace and safety and security. But this president doesn't really seem to be able to do that.
Well, I don't recall anybody much in any public office inciting violence against their fellow Americans. Maybe you'd have to go back to the civil rights struggles. I don't know whether there are any other examples, but just on Sunday, Congressman Steve King in Iowa, he posted something that quickly went viral, quoting, "Folks keep talking about another civil war. One side has about 8 trillion bullets, while the other side doesn't know which bathroom to use. I wonder who would win." I mean, that's both divisive, but also threatening, is it not?
No, those are stunning comments. I can't understand why anyone would make, you know, remarks that are just so ridiculous and spiteful in the public sphere. Part of this movement, which is, you know, it's a political set of ideas, is the idea that, you know, a way of life, a culture, is deeply threatened. I mean, this is what white supremacy is about, is the idea of, you know, white people need to be in power and control all aspects of society, and that's the natural order of things. And they feel, you know, extremely threatened by global events, globalization of the economy. They feel threatened by immigration. They feel threatened by demographics. And when you have this culture of grievance and threat of losing control, you resort to this idea that, you know, somehow you'll be able to prevent these massive changes. And people then, you know, turn towards violence as a means to do that. So King seems to be reassuring people that, oh, it's okay. We'll be able to crush multiculturalism. We'll be able to crush, you know, gay rights movements or other things that they don't approve of through the use of violence. And, you know, what can you say? It's just this, it's disgusting. And I think it's deemed to backfire ultimately, but that doesn't mean it's not. It should be called out and shown for what it is, which is just shameful.
So if you can't shame these people into silence, is there anything that can be done about the means by which they propagate their hateful propaganda and by which they recruit their adherents over the Internet? I mean, this killer in New Zealand live-streamed, he had a helmet camera on, live-streamed the whole horrible incident. And, you know, that's actually been used by the president of Turkey, Erdogan, in rallies to generate sort of anti-Western paranoia. That he even went so far as to suggest that the New Zealanders in 1915 who invaded Gallipoli are at it again, you know, killing Muslims. So is there anything that can be done? Obviously, there's a lot of commentators and analysts have talked about the connections to social media as a kind of fuel that inflames this problem. Is there anything that can be done in that regard?
I know there's been discussion about technically how to deal with the live streaming problem, and I think we can put that in one category of issues that people think there are fixes for and you know, ought to be implemented. I will say that I think there have been efforts made by Facebook, by YouTube, by Twitter to do more and act more quickly. They have user agreements that they can enforce and content restrictions that they can put in place that are not governed by the First Amendment. These are private companies, private platforms. It's not a form of government censorship when YouTube takes down a video, denies people accounts. Facebook does the same. I think they've got large offices that are dealing with these things, and they're dedicating resources to it. I agree that they should, they need absolutely to do more. I think you have to, it's very hard to define what is hate speech and what is political speech. So it's a difficult line to draw, but I know they have a lot of smart legal minds and technical minds that are going to the problem. I would say we need to do more of that and act more quickly.
But has the sort of horse bolted and is down the paddock in terms of one of the things that is pernicious about the Internet, and this is not just to do with terrorism, but to do with just your general public discourse, is that people are able to hide behind a handle, whether it's a Twitter handle or an email handle, and not have to identify who they are. Is there any way that you can come up with a regime where people have to literally own what they say?
Well, you know, the history of the Internet, I think the when it was put together and it blossomed and expanded, I think the thought was it was going to be an unmitigated good for society, for openness, for free speech, would be a threat to autocratic governments, would be a threat to, you know, these kind of fringe movements. And as we know, it, of course, the Internet has provided a lot of public good and can be used to seek justice and organize people who are trying to, you know, fight for freedom and for liberty. But it, and especially in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, has really degraded. And governments, authoritarian governments, are learning how to use it for to suppress freedom more often than the other direction. So I think in the early days, because, you know, we thought it was going to be an unmitigated good, the idea was that government should not regulate, should not be involved in shaping how the content and how this new technology was being used. But more and more, both for privacy purposes and for these other hate speech issues, I think there is more and more call and more willingness for people to think about how this particular technology ought to be regulated. Now, again, we have the First Amendment in the United States, which cabins off a lot of certain types of government activities. But that doesn't mean that, you know, again, both the platforms themselves to self-regulate on a voluntary basis and also some forms of government regulation, which were just politically not feasible, I think are now we're having discussions about that.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's been a great discussion under bad circumstances, but thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks again, and I've been speaking with David Chancellor, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch include special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the love fest in the White House Rose Garden today between President Trump and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alexander Main, the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which focuses on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, U.S. development assistance to Haiti, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Main.
Thank you.
And Alexander, what did you make of the meeting today at the White House between Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil, newly elected president, and Donald Trump? It did sort of seem like a something of a love fest, at least the press conference that followed their meeting was. How does it strike you?
Yeah, I was going to use the same phrase of love fest, very much so. And Bolsonaro, who was interviewed by Fox News and the Christian Broadcasting Network beforehand, made sure to mention a lot of things that were sure to make Trump very happy, such as, you know, his support for the wall along the U.S.'s southern border, allegations that, you know, immigrants have, you know, their own interests in mind, that are they are basically a negative influence on the U.S. He also later on talked about the problem of fake news and so on. So, you know, very much showed that he was sharing, you know, the values and vision of President Trump. But there were no major surprises in the press conference that they held after their meeting today. As expected, Trump has decided that the U.S. will support the designation of Brazil as a major non-NATO ally, which really allows for much deeper military cooperation between the two countries and with, of course, NATO members. And it'll allow also the Brazilian military to have access to more sensitive technology, you know, very special training from the U.S. and to certain weapons, including, you know, depleted uranium and so on, that they wouldn't have access to otherwise. So that was one of the major announcements. And the other one, which didn't come as much of a surprise either, was that they're going to cooperate more closely on Venezuela. I mean, that's something that the Trump administration made very clear that they were interested in doing with Brazil. And in fact, they have been doing it. It's not clear what the deeper cooperation will entail, except that most likely the Brazilian military will again be involved in that. The U.S. Has made clear, actually, and you've had U.S. officials that have already said this to the media, that they are hoping that the Brazilian military, which has close relations to the Venezuelan military, can help them in their campaign to persuade the Venezuelan military to turn against the government of Nicolas Maduro and support the self-appointed interim president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, who's course been recognized by the U.S. and Brazil and a number of other countries. So essentially, you know, helping the U.S. advance its goal of a military coup or rebellion against the Maduro government. It's likely that they've talked about other plans as well with regards to Venezuela, but they, you know, they weren't making any sort of public pronouncements about those plans during the press conference in any case.
But hasn't Brazil been impacted by refugees from Venezuela, as has Colombia?
It certainly has, not to the same extent as Colombia. The border that Venezuela has with Brazil is, you know, essentially mostly in the Amazon rainforest and is very sparsely populated. And so, you know, there isn't as much sort of migrant traffic on that border. But the northern states of Brazil have certainly been affected, and it's been mostly particularly poor Venezuelans that have been traveling to Brazil and that, you know, require, I would say, even more assistance than many of the migrants that have been traveling elsewhere from Venezuela. So it has become an issue, and in Brazil itself, there's sort of growing xenophobia, I would say, towards the Venezuelan migration, and particularly in Brazil's northern states. So what's happening in Venezuela is affecting them. However, there is no indication that Brazil really wants to get much more involved in the crisis in Venezuela, at least not so far. In fact, you had, you know, members of the Bolsonaro administration, Bolsonaro himself, that had sort of left open the possibility of Brazil participating in some sort of military intervention in Venezuela. But then the vice president, Mourão, who came out, that's the vice president of Brazil, he's a former general, and he came out, and members of the Brazilian Armed Forces also came out, you know, in strong opposition to that idea. And it seems unlikely that that will take place.
Well, there again, there's a similarity between Bolsonaro and Trump. Trump has recklessly said on a number of occasions that the military option vis-a-vis the U.S. doing something militarily towards Venezuela is still on the table, and you have Bolsonaro saying the same thing. I mean, that would be the worst possible thing in the world. I mean, the policy at the moment seems to be, from the Trump administration, they're almost sort of throwing gas on the combustible situation to spark a civil war. But American boots on the ground or Brazilian boots on the ground would be a catastrophe, I would think. Again, I'm...
Absolutely. And I think at this stage it's unlikely that we'll see Brazilian troops going in. I think where there's maybe a stronger likelihood is from Colombia at the moment, where you've had, I would say, even more bellicose positions coming from Colombia's right-wing president, Duque. And certainly, some amount of saber-rattling coming from the Colombian end as well. So it's more likely to come from there. But I think the goal seems to be for the U.S. more than anything to try to provoke this coup, a shift of allegiance of the Venezuelan armed forces from Maduro to Guaido, you know, which is something that would probably be very, very messy indeed and very bloody. It's unlikely that it would be very smooth. It's unlikely that it would be, if it were to occur, that it would be the entire Venezuelan armed forces. It would more likely be factions within the armed forces. And, of course, this would raise the possibility of an internal armed conflict, just as Colombia's had, a similar conflict for decades.
So again, I'm speaking with Alexander Main, who's a Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with a focus on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, U.S. development assistance to Haiti, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. So, of course, he's left of some political scandals at home. He's hardly been in office very much. But just back to the Rose Garden love fest between Bolsonaro and Trump. In the Rose Garden, at the press conference after their meeting, Bolsonaro urged Brazil and the U.S. to, quote, stand side by side in their efforts to ensure liberty and respect for traditional family lifestyles with respect to God and against politically correct attitudes and against fake news. And that prompted Trump to gushingly say, I'm very proud to hear the president use the term fake news. So this is this also, you mentioned, he was on the Christian Network before Bolsonaro, so that must have been music to their ears as well.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, so similarly to Trump, Bolsonaro has relied a great deal on social media. And similarly to Trump, I mean, he's benefited from an enormous amount of fake news himself. So there's some irony to both he and Trump agreeing that fake news is a problem. Fake news actually helped them both get elected. Certainly in Bolsonaro, it was very much the case. You saw Trump, who, went after Facebook and Twitter and so on. And, interestingly, Facebook helped both Trump and Bolsonaro, and I would say particularly Bolsonaro. I think there isn't a lot of awareness of this, of the extent of fake news that was
disseminated,
communicated during the campaign, during the presidential campaign in Brazil last year. Enormous lies regarding the main opposition to Bolsonaro, the Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, accusing him, for instance, of wanting to create classes to teach kids homosexuality in schools, in public schools in Brazil, to teach children, the virtues of homosexuality. And of course, this was something that absolutely terrorized a lot of Bolsonaro's base. It's, you know, it was very, very conservative, very reactionary. You know, so this idea was a terrifying one, but a complete lie, a complete invention. But one that polls showed that even after the presidential election, that a full 40% of the population believed. And so this this sort of fake news very much swung the election in favor of Bolsonaro, and it took place almost entirely across social media, and particularly the WhatsApp application that, of course, belongs to Facebook. It was used very strategically. There were also reports that illicit funding went into this WhatsApp campaign of fake news. There still needs to be a lot of investigating around that, but it appears that the Bolsonaro campaign benefited not just from fake news, but also from this illicit funding.
So one of the things, of course, it was so obvious at the press conference in the Rose Garden after the meeting between Bolsonaro and Trump was that Trump only limited the questions to organizations friendly to the White House, like the Daily Caller and Fox. Is that, do you think that's going to be the way he does business from now on? Because he seems to be, you know, all that weird tweeting over the weekend sort of indicates that he feels completely besieged and paranoid about all the terrible things that are being said about him. In fact, he went on to talk about that again, saying that, there's collusion with YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, and quoting Trump, something has to be going on. The hatred they have for a certain group of people that happen to be in power, obviously talking about himself, I do think we have to get to the bottom of it. It's fair to say we have to do something about it. So it's almost like Trump is saying that he's going to somehow use the power of being president of the United States to make sure he gets better coverage and people love him instead of criticize him.
Well, absolutely. And Bolsonaro has engaged in similar sort of threats towards the media. And in fact, when an investigative report emerged, you know, just after his campaign, suggesting that there was illicit funding of his campaign, he proceeded to threaten the media, and the journalist who produced this investigative report received death threats and so on. I think he even had to leave the country at one point. And, you know, in general, Bolsonaro has sort of created this, I would say, threatening atmosphere with very hateful speech, which his supporters often see as marching orders to go after particular individuals. I mean, this happened as well for the first openly gay member of Brazil's Congress, John Willis, who, you know, received threats from Bolsonaro and is now in exile, seeking asylum. He and his family were receiving numerous death threats. You know, we see similar things happening to many of the activists in Brazil. So it's creating a very ugly atmosphere, and I would say Bolsonaro goes a little bit further than Trump because, of course, he's a big admirer of Brazil's, you know, military dictatorship that lasted from 1964 to 1985 and that disappeared, murdered, tortured thousands of political opponents. And Bolsonaro, during his campaign last year, said that the military dictatorship hadn't gone far enough, and he also promised to purge Brazil of, you know, leftist terrorists, suggesting that they would either be jailed or be forced into exile. So he's, I think, gone a bit further than Trump in sort of the level of threats and intimidation against opponents of all sorts that he faces, but certainly, I mean, they sort of share the same quality of, you know, making threats and I think mobilizing supporters against the media and, you know, against people that they feel are standing in their way or are, you know, raising issues that they'd rather not be raised.
Well, the scandal that I mentioned that's emerging in Brazil just now as Bolsonaro is in the White House. It's what's been unearthed is links to paramilitary gangs and militia groups with the Bolsonaro family and their connections to two former Rio police officers arrested for the March 2018 assassination of a Rio councilwoman, Marielle Franco. It seems that there are all kinds of layers of relationships between Bolsonaro and his sons, who are also active in politics, and some of the most violent elements in Brazilian society. So do you think that this scandal has legs?
Oh, I think it absolutely has legs. I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg, really. And, you know, this information emerged because of the investigation into the assassination of Marielle Franco, who is a very, very prominent activist and politician who, you know, really was outspoken on LGBT and Afro-Brazilian rights, a big opponent of extrajudicial police killings in Rio. And of course, there are, you know, hundreds each year, and, you know, that tend to target black youth and, you know, that often are perpetrated against unarmed or disarmed individuals and with complete impunity. She also stood up against the militarization of Rio de Janeiro, which occurred early last year. And, you know, there's no doubt that these strong positions that she took were part of the motivation for her killing. And indeed, it emerged that the perpetrators of the killing, and we still don't know who ordered the killing, but certainly those that executed the killing, have links to Bolsonaro and his sons, and going back quite a long way. And they live in the same neighborhood. They've gone to one another's birthday parties and so on. So there's a great deal of proximity and intimacy between, you know, these murderous killers belonging to the militias that are essentially a paramilitary group, you know, an organized crime group that is made up of former police and that, you know, carries out murders on a regular basis in the poor neighborhoods. And these links, you know, appear to exist, and I think we're just beginning to get a sense of the fact that they run very, very deep. So I expect we'll be hearing more about this, and I think, you know, Bolsonaro is hoping with this U.S. trip that he can change the conversation, but I don't think he'll manage to do that.
Well, Alexander Bain, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Bain, who's a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with a focus on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, U.S. development assistance to Haiti, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.